Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Katie Weaver, Phil Dierking, and Mario Ritter. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us America's Presidents. But first, Dashita Tufa grew up in the Oromia region of Ethiopia. He worked on his family's farm with his 13 brothers and sisters until he left to become a school teacher. In time, Tufa became involved in politics. He helped campaign for a political party that opposed the majority Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front. Soon, Tufa felt he was not safe and decided to leave. He entered the United States in 1992 as a refugee. Tufa settled in Minneapolis, a large city in the northern state of Minnesota. There, he began working as a dishwasher. He also worked at manufacturing companies and as a security guard. Sometimes he had two or three jobs at the same time. But he did not earn enough money at these jobs to support his wife and five children. So he began working evenings and weekends, driving older people and people with disabilities to and from work. He says he fell in love with transportation. In 2003, he and his brother decided to open their own transportation company. He began with his wife's van. Soon, schools began using their service. School officials told other schools about the excellent service Tufa was providing. The company grew. Metropolitan Transportation Network now has almost 300 buses and vans that take children to schools across the state. Each day, Tufa's company transports more than 15,000 children to schools and other places in Minneapolis, as well as to other cities. More than 300 people now work at the company. It recently moved to a new, larger operations center. Tufa says he has always worked to keep students safe. Minnesota has long, snowy winters. Many buses bring children to their homes and drive away. But Tufa pays his drivers to wait until the students are inside their homes or are met by an adult. He also works to help others in the Oromo community. The Minnesota Historical Society estimates 40,000 Oromos live in Minnesota. Tufa helps his employees who want to start their own business. Since 2012, three former employees have started their own successful transportation companies. Tufa says, "The greatest gift I think you can give people like you is that it can be done, and I feel like I've done that." He says his success is a lesson for all African immigrants working to become successful in the United States. "When a person is free, you can do anything," he said. "So appreciate what you have, work so very hard, and get rid of the wrong pride we have back home that if you have a college degree, you have to be in a professional line of work, and you can't dig the potatoes or do the dishes. Work is work, and go out there and do what is available. Be proud of it." Tufa believes his experience shows that for those willing to work hard, anything is possible. He told VOA, "I do not believe in giving up."
Educators and volunteers in Egypt are teaching the children of refugee families from many African countries. They are working with the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, churches, and non-governmental organizations, or NGOs. Chris Rupke is a teacher at the African Hope School in Mahdi, a town near Cairo. It is one of about 60 schools in Egypt for refugee children. Rupke told VOA that some of the children he teaches have lost one or both of their parents.
Some of them have a mother, some of them have a father, some of them might be living with aunts or uncles, or some of them might be living with tribal members and they call them aunts or uncles.
Nuclear families as we know them in the West are not that common here, Rupke adds. Rupke says that one boy was so traumatized by what he had seen in his home country that he was unable to speak. Then a psychologist at the school got him to draw pictures of what had happened.
She had him draw pictures. And what he drew was his village. She asked him, draw your village. And he drew his village, and he drew his father and his mother and his siblings, and they were in pieces. When she said, where's your father? He pointed to some pieces on the ground.
After he drew the picture and worked with the psychologist, the little boy began to talk. Jean-P has taught at the African Hope School since 2003. The school teaches about 460 students. Jean-P told VOA that when he began, he and his co-workers went looking for refugee children under Cairo's bridges and in its public gardens. He learned how to persuade them to come to school. We have a school here, so we can put you there. It's free, he told them.
There's food, and when they hear about food, then they come.
Most classes at the refugee schools are taught in English. The students learn math, Arabic, science, literacy, social studies, computers, and personal development. African refugee families often struggle to earn enough money to pay for food. One NGO that is providing aid is Refuge Egypt. The Anglican Church in Cairo operates the group. It gives refugees sugar, flour, cooking oil, and free medical treatment at a health clinic it operates. It can be difficult for many African refugees to stay in Egypt. They must receive an asylum seeker card from the United Nations Refugee Agency. A spokesman for the UNHCR Cairo office tells VOA that the card protects refugees from being deported to their home countries. An agreement between the UNHCR and Egypt, reached in 1954, permits refugees from some countries to send their children to Egyptian schools and to receive care at government-operated medical facilities. But Egyptian government schools are often too crowded to accept many refugee students. And some of the children do not speak Arabic, so it is difficult for them to learn. Most refugee children like going to school. They love to play with other children and learn. Chris Rupke says teachers work hard and show the students love.
We do know that the students love to come here because they know it's a safe place. And it is a place that they will see love.
I'm Katie Weaver.
There is no doubt that Mount Everest is the world's highest mountain. But how tall is it exactly? And did the powerful earthquake that struck in the high Himalayan mountains 2 years ago reduce its size? To answer these questions, Nepal has started an ambitious 2-year project to remeasure the famous mountain. Officials working on the project hope to put an end to conflicting information about the mountain's size. The project is also about national pride. Until now, the measurements of Mount Everest have mostly come from Indian and Chinese studies. Now Nepal wants to decide the height of Everest on its own.
Everest is on the border between Nepal and China. Ganesh Prasad Bahata is Director General of Nepal's Survey Department. He calls Mount Everest Nepal's baby. I used to say since the birth of Mount Everest, Nepal has not measured it, Bahata said. But Nepal has the ability to do so, he said. And the new project will help show that Nepal is able to, in his words, carry out any kind of challenging survey work on its own. Nepal is home to 8 of the world's 14 mountains that are taller than 8,000 meters. Everest is the mountain that is most central to the country's economy. Every year, climbers from around the world come to try to reach its peak.
In 2015, a 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Nepal. It caused major landslides on Everest. People have since questioned whether the quake changed the mountain's height. Climbers and locals say parts of Everest's main trail are becoming rockier as they lose snow cover. India offered to remeasure the mountain earlier this year. However, some Nepalese felt that the next measurement of Everest should be done by a team from their own country. Jubaraj Kimir is a Nepalese commentator. He said people in Nepal feel it is important to not just find the true measurement of Everest, but also to have a measurement of their own.
Nepal hopes to deliver the final measurement of the mountain in 2 years. Bahata said his office is finalizing its methods. A team of Sherpas will go to the top of Everest with measuring equipment in April or October of next year. Officials say they hope to get international support of the data. They also say they may permit international scientists to join the project, as scientists aim to end the debate on the height of Everest. People who live in the area have different concerns. Aung Tsering Sherpa is one of them. He is an experienced mountaineer and grew up in a village next to Everest. Sherpa said some locals believe that Mount Everest is huge, unchanging, and strong. But he said he has observed how climate change is affecting the mountain. The truth is, this is one of the most vulnerable areas in the world because of the impact of climate change. White snow peaks and glaciers are melting rapidly, Sherpa said, adding that the melting is happening faster than ever.
Hurricane Maria severely damaged Puerto Rico's electricity and communications systems. Millions of people there are without power, water, or food. The storm also caused damage to a well-known scientific tool in the U.S. territory, the Arecibo Observatory. Until last year, it was the largest single telescope of its kind in the world. Many of the observatory's instruments appear to be unharmed. Arecibo Deputy Director Joan Schmeltz called that a thing to be thankful for in an interview with the Associated Press. But a large antenna used to study the Earth's upper atmosphere, broke during the storm, the AP reported. Damage to the observatory is estimated to be in the millions of dollars. The observatory is home to the Arecibo Radio Telescope, a 305-meter-wide dish. It collects radio waves and focuses them onto scientific instruments that measure and process them. The instruments are suspended above the dish on towers over 80 meters high. During the storm, a small group of researchers remained at the observatory. They stayed in its concrete buildings. They had some food and water, but like most in Puerto Rico, were cut off from the rest of the world. Perhaps not surprisingly, the first people that the researchers were able to contact after the storm were amateur radio operators. The storm damage threatens the telescope's future in several ways. It is supported by the National Science Foundation, or NSF, in Virginia, as well as the U.S. Space Agency, NASA. Funding limitations and the desire to build and operate newer telescopes has made the NSF think about cutting its support for older telescopes. Arecibo could face closure if money cannot be found to repair it and to continue operations. The Arecibo Radio Telescope has been involved in well-known scientific research since first being used in the 1960s. It was used to find an unusual kind of star system, a binary pulsar, in 1967. The discovery received a Nobel Prize in 1974. The telescope can be used to study radio signals coming from space. It also can send out radio waves as radar. Radar can be used to study conditions in the Earth's atmosphere and detect asteroids that pass dangerously close to Earth. The huge dish was also part of the SETI project, an effort to search for signs of extraterrestrial life. The Arecibo telescope was surpassed in size last July by the 500-meter aperture spherical telescope in Guizhou, China. Hurricane Maria, a Category 4 storm, left most of Puerto Rico's 3.4 million U.S. citizens without power or basic necessities. Telephone communications were nearly wiped out as the storm destroyed cell phone towers. The observatory is expected to be closed for some time because of the damage. Scientists may be able to carry out some kinds of observations soon, but others will not be possible for a long time. James Ulvestad is acting director for NSF's Math and Physics Directorate. He said research, like bouncing radar off of other planets, requires a lot of power from the island's electricity grid, which was severely damaged by the hurricane. The recovery response has been slow, as supplies need to be flown in or shipped to the island. President Donald Trump has promised the island aid. Damage is estimated to be in the billions of dollars. Meanwhile, workers with the Federal Emergency Management Agency are trying to set up aid centers across the U.S. territory. Puerto Rico's government is also burdened by tens of billions of dollars in debt that it is unable to pay. The island is seeking protection from its creditors in the biggest government bankruptcy in U.S. history. I'm Mario Ritter.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He was related to an earlier president with the same last name, Theodore Roosevelt. Many Americans call Franklin Roosevelt by the first letter of each word in his full name, FDR. When FDR took office, the United States was in a severe economic depression. The previous president, Herbert Hoover, had tried to improve the economy, but his efforts had failed. FDR defeated Hoover in the election of 1932. He won, in part, by promising what he called a New Deal for Americans. Voters did not know what FDR's New Deal meant exactly, but many liked his message of hope. Voters also did not know how much FDR would change the country. He remained in office for 12 years, the longest of any U.S. president, and led the country through the Great Depression and most of World War II. Along the way, he changed the way government affected Americans' lives and the job of the U.S. president. Franklin Roosevelt was born on a large estate in New York, about 140 kilometers outside New York City. He was the only child of wealthy parents. His mother and father made sure he had an excellent education. As a young man, he attended a private high school and then Harvard College in Massachusetts. He also studied law at Columbia University in New York. Young FDR was not an excellent student, however. He was interested in many things outside the classroom, including politics and girls. Two of FDR's interests came together in a young woman named Anna Eleanor Roosevelt, who went by the name Eleanor. She was the niece of a politician FDR greatly respected, President Theodore Roosevelt. On the day when Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt were married, Theodore Roosevelt attended the ceremony. In fact, he walked with his niece in front of the guests to her future husband. Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt went on to have 6 children, although one died as a baby. While Eleanor Roosevelt raised the children, Franklin Roosevelt directed his attention to politics. He left a job in a law office to serve in the New York State Senate. In time, he was offered a job in the federal government as an assistant secretary of the Navy. FDR enjoyed the job, but he continued seeking other political positions. He tried unsuccessfully for a seat in the U.S. Senate, but did get nominated by the Democratic Party to be its vice presidential candidate in 1920. Although he and his partner lost the race, FDR seemed like he was in a good position for major political success. But then, something unexpected happened. When he was 39 years old, FDR suffered major health problems. One day he started to feel a pain in his back. The following day, his legs grew tired. Then his skin became sensitive. By the end of the week, both his legs were paralyzed. He could not move from the waist down. He remained paralyzed for the rest of his life. The next years were difficult for the Roosevelts. Eleanor and the children helped care for FDR, and he worked hard to recover some of his strength and physical abilities, especially by exercising. While he remained hopeful about his condition, FDR worried about his political career. He did not think the public would accept a leader who could not even walk by himself. So he took several measures. He created a small wheelchair that would not get too much attention. It was made from a dining room chair, with wheels instead of legs. He refused to let photographers take pictures of him being carried or struggling to move, and he found a way to appear as if he were walking. He used a cane or the arm of a partner to balance, and then he swung his hips to make his legs move forward. Using this method, FDR walked to the stage at the 1924 Democratic National Convention. He used the event to nominate the governor of New York for president. That man's bid did not succeed, but FDR showed himself to still be an able politician. 4 years later, FDR himself was elected governor of New York. He held the position in the early years of the country's economic crisis. In 1932, FDR was a candidate for president. He took the unusual step of appearing in person at the Democratic Convention to accept his party's nomination. His campaign was such a success that the Democrats took not only the White House, but majorities in both the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives. The strength of the Democratic Party in Congress would help FDR become one of the most powerful presidents the country had ever seen. Next week, we will continue our story of FDR and his presidency. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.